This is the first class in this series on the Mahayana Mahaparinirvana Sutra. When I first came to Santa Cruz Zen Center 10 years ago, the first class I did, as I recall, was on the Buddha's first teaching, Setting in Motion the Wheel of Dhamma Sutta, which is a great overview of the early teachings about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the Middle Way. And I thought it's appropriate now as a last full class series before leaving Santa Cruz Zen Center to finish with the Buddha's final teaching, one version of the Buddha's final teaching. The Buddha's passing away from this human life form, we often call parinirvana. Nirvana is like the cessation of suffering and the great freedom and release and unbinding, liberation from all suffering. And pari means like complete. So parinirvana usually refers to the complete cessation of a Buddha at the end of their human life. Usually we talk about parinirvana referring to Shakyamuni Buddha. So there are various scriptures called the Parinirvana Sutra in the Pali Canon, the early sutras of the Buddha. There's a Parinibbana Sutta, which talks about the Buddha's last days, actually the Buddha's last months. It has various stories of the time leading up to his Parinirvana. And that's an important sutta in the early tradition. And this one has the same name, but it's a completely different sutra. There's also a Parinirvana Brief Admonitions Sutra that we recite part of on Parinirvana Day when we celebrate the Buddha's Parinirvana in February, on February 15th. And that's a much shorter sutra that's coming from the Mahayana tradition, but also different. So this is three different scriptures called the Parinirvana Sutra, and I think there's others also. But this one we're looking at now is huge. It's one of the longest sutras there is. In the English translation we have, it's on, you know, really small print and on big pages, and that comes to, I think, 500 pages. So if you printed it as a regular book, it would probably be about 1,000 pages. Like there's the Flower Ornament Sutra is also a super long, epic sutra. It's about that length. So in the Mahayana, there's these grand, epic sutras, and this is one of them. And it doesn't seem to be so such a popular sutra in America. It's not studied so widely, maybe because it's so long and it's kind of complex, and the organization of it is not so readily apparent. but it has a lot of amazing teachings, and it was, as some sutras, you know, they call apocryphal when they later scholars say they were written in China, but this is not one of those. This is, we know that it arose in India, and we don't have the Sanskrit original, but we have fragments, Sanskrit fragments of this Parinirvana Sutra, and we have full Chinese translations, several Chinese translations that are slightly different, done by different translators, around the year 400, the 5th century. And we have an early Tibetan translation, too, from the Sanskrit. So one reason why I felt like this would be a good sutra to study is the more I look into it, early Zen in China, Chan, we call it, in early Chinese Buddhism, this sutra was apparently like the main scriptural source for the teachings of Buddha nature in East Asia, so like China and Korea and Japan. There are some other sutras that teach Buddha nature, like the Lankavatara Sutra was important to Bodhidharma and early Zen also, and it brings up Buddha nature, but it's not the main theme of that sutra. And there are some others like the Tathagatagarbha Sutra and the Srimala Devi Sutra, taught by our woman ancestor, Acharya Srimala Devi. These are all kind of famous Buddha nature sutras. But none of them became quite so prominent as this Parinirvana Sutra. Maybe because it's really long and it's the main teaching of this sutra is Buddha nature, or sometimes we call it Tathagatagarbha. And also this Parinirvana Sutra teaches Buddha nature as the true self, which was a pretty radical thing to say in this tradition that from the very beginning of Buddhism taught not self as one of its central teachings. So it looks like the sutra probably appeared in India around the years 200 to 300, somewhere in there. So it's kind of an early Mahayana sutra. For those who kind of know the kind of Buddhist history some, Nagarjuna was a really important teacher of the middle way and emptiness. He lived around 150. So this Parinirvana Sutra probably came a little bit after Nagarjuna, and everyone was influenced by Nagarjuna's emptiness teachings after his time. So this sutra, I think, was also. But it's this sutra seems to appear before the great Yogacara founders, Asanga and Vasubandhu, who lived about 350 in the 4th century. This movement we call Yogacara, or Chitta Matra, which means mind only, this mind only tradition, which also kind of later was kind of woven together with Buddha nature teachings. They fit together nicely. In fact, the Lankavatara Sutra is really a combination of Yogacara, mind-only system mixed in with Buddha nature. But this Parinirvana Sutra is prior to Yogacara teachings. Yogacara emphasizes things like the storehouse consciousness. There's a model of 8 consciousnesses, and including the storehouse consciousness, which later got kind of connected to Buddha nature. But this is a prior to that whole 8 consciousness thing. This Parinirvana Sutra arose before the teaching of storehouse consciousness, or Alaya Vijnana, came on the scene. And it arose before the teaching of everything is mind only. So it's early Buddha nature, early presentation of Buddha nature, and particularly emphasizing this true self. as the nature of all beings, to self as a kind of eternal, unchanging, pure reality, free from all suffering. And so if it was written about 200 or 300 in India, it was first translated from Sanskrit into Chinese around the year 400. A couple of translations appeared. And remember, Bodhidharma appeared in China around 500. So it was before the time of Bodhidharma, before the time of Zen. And around this time of 400, 500, though, this sutra became very popular in China, so popular that there were these different movements, different schools of Buddhism in China. One of them was called the Nirvana School, based on this sutra. That was a kind of thing that was happening in early Chinese Buddhism, as there were schools of Buddhism based on different Mahayana sutras. So there's like a flower ornament school based on the flower ornament or Avatamsaka Sutra, and a Pure Land school in China, which still exists in China and Japan, based on the Pure Land Sutras. So most of these schools in China, different movements or understandings of Buddha's teaching, were based on these important Mahayana sutras that understand or put things slightly differently, and they became like movements. And of course, Zen became kind of like a school in China. And the kind of trademark thing of Zen is the separate transmission outside the scriptures. So that kind of statement makes more sense when we know that it arose in this milieu of all these schools that were based on different scriptures, different sutras. So Zen is like a new school, but like we're not based on one of those sutras. We're just based on like pointing directly to the nature of mind and being Buddha. So Zen was kind of this radical, direct experience kind of school. Of course, early Zen teachers were always quoting sutras, but they weren't locked into any one of them. And one that they quoted somewhat frequently in early Chinese Zen is this Parinirvana Sutra. The sixth ancestor brings it up in early Zen, and all the way through to Dogen, bases his Buddha nature essay, Shobogenzo Busho. He starts with a quote from this Parinirvana Sutra. So, with all that as the background, let's hear from the sutra a little bit. And next week I can bring a printed handout for people who want. You don't even really need the handout. I think we'll always just be talking about bits and pieces. But because this is like, you know, a 1,000-page sutra, I just, for my own study's sake, trying to understand this and look into this sutra, spent some months over the last year really going through it, and particularly looking at the teachings of Buddha nature and true self. There's a lot of stuff going on in these 1,000 pages, but this theme keeps coming back, woven all throughout, pages and pages devoted to describing the Buddha nature and true self from all these different angles. And so this handout that I collected is basically like these excerpts on this theme. I felt like important different ways of talking about it, and that I kind of condensed into like 6 pages. I think I sent it to everybody via email, who has email. And so when we have electricity again, we can print some out.
And just to say that the whole 1,000-page epic can be printed or can be downloaded for free.
Yes, I think if you just Google Mahaparinirvana Sutra PDF, I think it's various places on the web. For those who have a link to my Kokyo's personal website, it's on, there's a link there to the PDF on the, in the Parinirvana Sutra section. This is a translation from the Sanskrit by Dharmakshema in the year 430. That's the one that seemed to stick in China, of the various Chinese translations, the one that became popular. And then it was translated into English in the 70s by Kosho Yamamoto, a Japanese, I'm not sure if he was Zen teacher, but Japanese Buddhist teacher. And there's a more recent translation of like the first volume, it's like the first third, I think, of the sutra, by Mark Bloom, that's also available for free online as a PDF. The 70s one is because Yamamoto, the translator, has English as a second language, it's a little funny sometimes. So in this handout, I tried to edit it, the English too. So here's just the introduction. It's nice, it doesn't say that much about the main teachings, but it kind of sets the stage for the sutra. Thus have I heard. That's how all the sutras begin. At one time, the Buddha was staying at Kushinagara in the land of the Malas, close to the river Adityavati, where the twin Sala trees stood. So all the Parinirvana sutras speak of the Buddha's passing in Parinirvana, and Yaro and I and Ken and some other people around here visited Kushinagara.
Rachel.
Mm-hmm. And a group of others went on a pilgrimage in India, and Kushinagara, there's the site where the Buddha's Parinirvana happened, and there's also a cremation stupa where the Buddha was cremated, and it's a beautiful place to contemplate impermanence. And there's these Sala trees still grow all around this site, and the river Adityavati still flows through this town, little town of Kushinagara, in northern India. At that time, many great monks, 80 billion, 100,000, were with the Blessed One. I'm not sure if that's a real number. They surrounded him front and back. On the 15th day of the second month, and I think that this is probably the source for us in the Zen tradition celebrating Buddha's Parinirvana on February 15th. It doesn't say this in the Pali sutras. So, for whatever reason, this sutra describes this Parinirvana is happening on the full moon is the 15th day in the lunar calendar of the second month. So we, in modern Japan, it's February 15th, wherever the moon is. So that's what we do. As the Buddha was about to enter Nirvana, he with his divine power spoke in a great voice which filled the whole world and reached the highest of the heavens. It said to all beings in a way that each could understand. So, all beings in whatever language, and maybe often when you see paintings, like modern Japanese paintings of Buddha's Parinirvana, they have the monks around the Buddha, they have the bodhisattvas with their all their ornaments, and they also have all these animals hanging around the Buddha. So I think it's this emphasizing that all beings were gathering around the great Shakyamuni Buddha. And he spoke in his voice that all beings could understand in their own way through the Buddha's miraculous power, and said, today, the thus come one, the Tathagata, the worthy one, the perfectly awakened one, has compassion for, protects, and with an undivided mind, sees all beings as he sees his own child, Rahula. Therefore, he's the refuge and sanctuary for the whole world. The greatly awakened Blessed One is about to enter Nirvana. All beings who have doubts may now ask questions. And that's a statement the Buddha makes in the early Theravada Pali Parinirvana Sutta too. He says, I'm about to enter Nirvana, so if you have any last questions or doubts, now's the time. And of course, people do ask. At that time, early in the morning, the world-honored one emitted from his mouth rays of light of various hues, namely blue, yellow, red, white, crystal, and agate-colored light rays. The rays of light shine throughout the 3,000 great thousand-fold Buddha lands. All 10 directions were equally illuminated. So that's the setting. It's the Buddha's last day in the early morning. And it's, you know, if you were to read this 1,000 pages really fast, you might be able to finish in 24 hours, but it might be like the Buddha's speech was sort of compressed, or it seemed to expand all these teachings, but they all happened the last day, and he entered Nirvana in the middle of the night. But this is, the setting is, it sounds like it's the Buddha's last day when he's teaching all this. And I think as a Dharma teaching, it's interesting too that this teaching of Buddha nature and true self is put into this Parinirvana Sutra. It's taught as the Buddha's final teaching. The Buddha really began his teaching, supposedly the second teaching he ever gave after setting in motion the wheel of Dhamma, was on Anatman. It's called the Anatta Lakana Sutta. So he taught this not self very early on to his group of five friends. So not self was right at the beginning, and then right at the end is his true self. Kind of like revealing this sort of secret teaching, and it's presented sometimes in the sutra as a kind of hidden secret teaching of true self. Just before I go, I'll let you know about this that I haven't yet brought forth. That's kind of the feeling here. So this sutra also teaches not self quite a bit. So it's they're not contradictory, the teaching of anatman or not self and the teaching of atman or true self are actually not contradictory in the sutra. They're both taught, and I don't see anything in this radical Mahayana sutra that directly contradicts the early teachings. I would say it more just like it builds on them and offers further teachings. The Mahayana sutras try to be good about staying within the Buddhist tradition, which teaches that all compounded phenomena are not self and are impermanent and so on. And it does it in a beautiful way. So I thought in this class series we could focus on this main point of the sutra, the true self and as Buddha nature, and also this teachings of not-self, and to clarify the difference between them and the non-contradictoriness between them, and make it a really practical, personal exploration of our own selves and our own experience. So I think it's natural to start such a discussion looking at the teachings of not-self, which were understood when the sutra came to be, and are easily misunderstood. I think we probably all heard this teaching of not self or anatman, but it's quite subtle, I think, what it actually means and why it was so important to the Buddha for relieving suffering too. So just to have a little taste of the Buddha's not self teachings, it's in chapter 2 of this many-chaptered sutra, the Buddha says, now meditate upon all that is constructed, all that's composite, or all that's compounded. It's this Sanskrit word, sanskrita, which incidentally is the same word as Sanskrit, the language Sanskrit. is just another way of pronouncing Sanskrita, which means compounded or constructed. So I think it's a kind of neat thing that the language of ancient India is called the constructed. And I think there's a kind of a spiritual teaching in here about this language, the name of this language, and also Sanskrit, even in present times, is considered like a sacred language in both Hinduism. Maybe it started being thought of that way in kind of pre-Buddhist, Vedic religion, that language itself is a sacred thing because it's how we meet, and it's actually what helps to construct the world. Language constructs our understanding of the world. So Sanskrit means, like, we could even say, like, the constructor of the world. Language is constructed and constructs ideas and concepts, what we call the world. So that's a little footnote on Sanskrit, which is a term the Buddha uses all the time. All phenomena, all things are constructed, composite, compounded, Sanskrit. Meditate upon this, he says. Contemplate how all things, all of these constructed things, are not self, anatman, and they're not permanent or not eternal, anitya, and that nothing endures. So that's what the Buddha says in the sutra, and that's completely in accord with all the early teachings, that all compounded, constructed phenomena, which phenomena or dharmas in Buddha's teaching usually means like experiences of body and mind. Yes?
So, I've been looking at the GPUs of mind, mm-hmm. So unconstructedness and stillness.
Yes.
Like
yeah.
Some of that language. Yep. Like,
yeah, yeah. So it's referring to this kind of teaching. Yeah. GGU's MI is unconstructedness. And that's what we're going to hear later in the sutra, that the true self, Buddha nature, is unconstructed and still. But in the early teachings, the Buddha is mostly emphasizing the constructed, which is all phenomena. And I think a nice way to look at what phenomena are is any experience, anything that we could possibly call an experience of body and mind. The five aggregates, right? The five skandhas are one model of trying to describe human experience. All human experience fits into these five aggregates. There's different models the Buddha sometimes uses too, having to do with like the six senses. The sixth sense being mental, mind-knowing things. That's another all-inclusive model. The six senses and the six sense objects includes all experience. But I think my favorite model for all-inclusive human experience is the five aggregates. Of course, it appears in the Heart Sutra. Actually, both those models appear in the Heart Sutra. So all phenomena can be categorized as form, which is like, we could say physical things, but the body, if we're talking about the four elements of the body, like earth, wind, fire, water, these are like kind of physical elements, these would be called form. And also the five physical senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, are considered the form aggregate. They're kind of a physicality, but they're a experiential kind of physicality. The Buddha is not so much into analyzing the four elements, things like this, like science might be interested in. The Buddha is more interested in analyzing and really exploring and looking at our own experience. So for us, form is experienced as eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body. And notice how they're compounded, they're constructed, which means they're what compounded, constructed means is that they're something that arises dependent on other conditions. They come to be and then they cease. They're impermanent. All constructed things are made from different elements, and then they cease. And isn't it true that eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body are like this? Feelings is the second aggregate, right? Feelings of pleasant or unpleasant sensation also are, they come to be through conditions, and they arise and they cease. They're impermanent. Conceptions, the third aggregate is perceptions or conceptions, is like the way that the mind gets a hold of experiences, even direct experiences like colors, the way the eyes get a hold of the color blue is described through this third aggregate of perception or conception. The eyes see the color, but then the mind gets a hold of like the signs of blue. The signs of blue are like that in the blue color, which is able to be known by the mind. Something like this is how perception or conceiving of experience works. And the fourth aggregate is karmic formations, which is like our habitual patterns and tendencies. And the fourth aggregate is called samskara, which is closely related to the term samskrita. That's what I call it. Formations is like constructed, dependent qualities of mind. Things like greed, hate, and delusion, and intention, and so on, fit into the fourth aggregate. And then the fifth aggregate is consciousness. By consciousness here we mean dualistic consciousness, vijnana, the way that the mind experiences the world, the way that seems to be a subject that knows objects. This is like dualistic consciousness, which is constructed because it arises dependent on the mind and objects. Consciousness is a dependent phenomena, and it's an impermanent phenomena. It arises dependent on particular experience and dependent on the mind. And when that experience changes, that consciousness ceases and another consciousness is born. That's the Buddha's model of the fifth aggregate or consciousness. So all these five aggregates are compounded, constructed, therefore they're impermanent, and they're also, therefore, not my true self, the Buddha taught. It's particularly what he taught in this supposedly second sutra he ever taught in the Deer Park at Isipatana near Varanasi. He taught that these five aggregates are not permanent. They're not ultimately satisfying. They're dukkha, and they're not my true self, because true self usually refers to something that would be permanent or always the case, something that we can feel like we actually are in an ongoing way. And these aggregates are, just because they're impermanent, they don't qualify as a kind of a ongoing, ever-present self. these marks or characteristics of phenomena, of, again, phenomena, we mean experiences. Five aggregates is one model of all phenomena, fit into five aggregates. These experiences are not ultimately satisfying. They're dukkha. They're not permanent, continuous, eternal. They're anicca, and they're not my true self, true permanent singular self, anatman. So that was a important early teaching, these three characteristics. This is a nice one to remember, right? They're not ultimately satisfying. Sometimes people translate it as all phenomena are suffering. I think it's okay. Dukkha is the term, but some people feel like, well, what about when I'm really totally enjoying myself? It doesn't seem like suffering. I think that's why it's nice to say all conditioned experiences are not ultimately satisfying. Even a really, really blissful moment, the Buddha's kind of pointing out, it's not ultimately satisfying just because it's impermanent. It's not going to last forever, and we kind of know that, and so that kind of it kind of is a little, it leaves a little smudge on our blissful experience that in the back of our mind we're like, well, I know it's just temporary. It's not ultimately satisfying. Ultimately satisfying would be eternally satisfying, which is kind of what the Buddha, I think, was looking for. So, all conditioned experiences are not ultimately satisfying. They're not permanent, which is why they're not ultimately satisfying. And because they're not permanent and they're not ultimately satisfying, therefore they're not my true self, which would be something that would be permanent and would be, if there were really my true self, some people might feel like that would be something that would be controllable into ultimate permanent satisfaction. But it's more like there's not that kind of a self that we can manipulate like that into ultimate satisfaction according to our will. So all experiences have these three characteristics. Yes.
And when did this test for the ultimate come about?
Test?
Well, looking at phenomena as is it satisfying? I mean, is it suffering? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
True self.
Mm-hmm.
When did those criteria come?
Those criteria were there in this second sutra ever, according to tradition. This is the Pali Sutras. Every week here we chant the Buddha's first teaching, which about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and the Middle Way, and in that sutra that we chant, that's tradition says is the very first teaching the Buddha ever gave. When the Buddha is describing dukkha, or what I'm calling not ultimately satisfying, slightly discontent, he teaches what he's defining dukkha, he's defining this discontent, and he says grasping the five aggregates is discontent. You know that part when we chant. Not getting what we want is discontent. Getting what we don't want is discontent. All these things that are quite obvious. But then he kind of summarizes them with a little piece of more subtle dharma to kind of sum up his definition of dukkha. He says, grasping the five aggregates is really how we define this discontent. Another way we could interpret that is grasping the five aggregates of the five skandhas of body and mind as myself, that is what discontent is. So he doesn't use the word self or not self in the first sutra, but we could understand that that little sentence as almost like the seed for this, for his next, very next second sutra, according to tradition, taught to the same five monks who were there in the Deer Park. I don't know if it was like the next day or the next week, but shortly after this first sutra, his next point that he wanted to bring up was about the five aggregates. So he kind of fleshed them out more. He defined them, form, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness, and said that these five aggregates have these three characteristics of ultimately dissatisfying, impermanent, and they are not self. So anatta in Pali, or anatman in Sanskrit. So that was Buddha's second teaching, a very important Pali tradition, Theravada Sutta. These three, so in that sutra you could say the main points are the five aggregates are defined, and these three marks or three characteristics, lakshana or lakkhana.
It seems to me that there's something that has to remain incomprehensible for us ordinary mortals in all this. Because when the Buddha, or when the Bodhisattva attains Buddhahood, he or she, upon that attainment, is no longer bound by time and space, and they've attained ultimate freedom from suffering.
Yes. So Buddha, of course, speaks about this even in the early sutras as nirvana, which there's one particularly well-known sutra where the Buddha talks about nirvana, which is kind of like the goal of early Buddhism, right? As the unborn, the undying, the uncompounded, the unconstructed, right? So it's interesting that in all the volumes of the Theravada Pali Canon, there are teachings like that, nirvana as the unborn, undying, uncompounded, unconstructed, which makes release or liberation from the born, the dying, the constructed possible. He teaches that. But it's kind of a small part of the teaching. But there's a lot of teaching in the early sutras about the constructed and the compounded and the born and the dying. I think that's because the Buddha didn't want us to get too caught up in, like, I just want to find this unconstructed true nirvana. The Buddha was encouraging that, but he said, let's really study how we grasp the constructed and the compounded. So there's a lot of teachings about the five aggregates and the six senses are all the compounded and constructed. Let's see how we grasp those, which is prevents nirvana. So that's the emphasis, I would say, in early Buddhism. And then later Buddhism, which this sutra is going to be all about, is going to be all about the unconstructed, uncompounded, true self of Buddha nature. But we're not going to get to that today.
And yet at the same time, after his awakening, the Buddha is still aware of unawakened beings.
Yes.
And chooses to teach for their benefit.
Yes.
And yet somehow in, I don't know what you call it, I don't think you call it a mind stream anymore of the Buddha, but within the awareness of the Buddha, there are still unawakened beings, and yet that's not a source of suffering for the Buddha. I mean, that's not something. I don't know. That's not something. That's something that needs attending to, if you will.
Yes.
The Buddha sees a need for teaching, giving teachings. But yet it's not something imperfect or a source of suffering within the Buddha's experience.
Yeah, so there's a lot of points there that could be talked about as we continue on. But I think it was nice that in the very first paragraph of this epic sutra, the Buddha says, I, as I'm about to pass into nirvana, see all these beings like my own child, Rahula. The Buddha had a son, you might know, named Rahula. And he says, all beings throughout the universe, I love as intimately as my own child. So that kind of compassion is interestingly right there at the beginning of the sutra, and almost like the source for it. Yeah. So, not self. I think it's really good to distinguish. Maybe we can even spend a couple of weeks looking at the not self teachings and what this means. Actually, I think it's nice to, as this class continues, we'll be able to distinguish three types of self. We could call them the conventionally true, apparent self. That's the kind of like the way we sort of function as a self. The ultimately true self of Buddha nature. And then the completely false illusion of self. And these would be three different ones. And when we say the word self, it often, it's not clear which one we're talking about. So I think, in this case, I hope by the end of this class we can really understand the clear distinctions between these three different types of self. And anytime we use the word self, we can be clear which one that we're talking about. So I think, the first one that I think might be helpful to approach this from is the conventionally true apparent self, the conventional self, the relative self. And here's a kind of working definition of this conventional self. And then I'll tell you what I think is a really nice definition for it, and then we'll kind of go through it slowly and unpack it. Let's say, for now, that the relatively true, the conventionally true apparent self is a convenient name for a causal series of body and mind experiences. I think this definition is condenses a lot of teaching into a short definition. So,
you put together that little.
Yeah, it's kind of influenced, largely influenced by Mark Sideritz, as a Buddhist scholar, has a definition almost just like this. I think it's a great contemplation. So again, the conventional self here, the conventional I, when I'm talking about myself, the conventional person, the conventional Kokyo, is a convenient name for a causal series of body and mind experiences.
That would be a particular series, right?
That's what I think, causal series, yeah. And when I brought this up to people before, they have mentioned exactly what you mentioned. Don't we have to say
a causal series, but a particular causal series?
Yeah, and some people have said, shouldn't we say a kind of regular, patterned causal series? Right? Because isn't our self of the five aggregates have a lot of regularity to it? We don't confuse my series with your series, for example. So these are interesting points that we can explore as we keep talking. But I also think we have to be careful not to get too particular or too regular about it, because that's what turns into the actual some sort of substantial self. So I still feel like pretty good about just leaving it as a causal series. When you hear the definition of causal series, then see what you think. So, but let's start with the beginning. The convenient name that self or I or me or person or Tokyo, these are all convenient names. They're all they all happen to be one word. In fact, interestingly, the word I is actually one letter, right? Just to be really, really convenient. And it's one syllable, it's one letter, and it's one stroke, right, to write it. Isn't that interesting?
In English,
yes. And that may not be coincidence. It may be because we really are looking for some. It's such an important concept to us. We want something very convenient and quick to say and quick to write. I. So but also if we say me or self or person, person's a convenient name for something very complex, right? It's a one word name. And our names, like Kokyo, right, is we put this name on something very ungraspable and complex, right? And why do we put this one name on such a thing? Because it's very convenient. If we were to just say, like if I'm defining myself as this particular collection of body and mind experiences, then I might say like, excuse me, will that collection of body and mind experiences pass the salt to this collection of body and mind experiences? That's so inconvenient, right? So how about just, will you pass the salt to me? Very convenient. And so it's a good thing, I think, to be convenient. But part of this convenience starts to trick us into thinking that there's something more. But now we're just talking, before we get into the trickery, we're just talking about the relative, ordinary, conventional sense of self, which I'm going to put in parentheses here, which is not a problem. This is not the self the Buddha is saying doesn't exist. And this is not the source of suffering, this conventional self. This is just how things work. So self here is a convenient name. Let's just remember it's just a convenient name. But it's a name for something particular, it's not a random name. It's a convenient name for a causal series of body and mind experiences. So causal series here, we mean that we don't just say I is a convenient name for this body and mind in this moment. And then according to what we heard earlier about the five skandhas, they're all impermanent, they're all gone already. We have a new set. That set just ceased, we have a new set of body and mind. I is a convenient name for body and mind, then what about the next body and mind? We'd say, is that a new I? That doesn't really make sense. If it's something impermanent, you'd have to have a new I for each body and mind. So I think this definition of self as a convenient name for a causal series of body and mind, because it's not just a moment-to-moment thing and there's no relation between them, between last moment's body and mind experience and this moment's body and mind experience. There's relationship between the present experience and a moment ago's experience and yesterday's experience and last year's experience and the day I was born, the day I was born. Remember, I, in this case, is just a convenient name for this causal series, so we're allowed to say it. I is a name for the causal series. It's the same causal series as when Kokyo was born in Connecticut many years ago. See how it's the same causal series, but a causal series, there's no continuous thing there. There's no thread of some sort of essence running through. A causal series, and this is worth considering and contemplating deeply. What is a causal series? The Buddha's teaching of dependent arising is that when this arises, this comes to be, and then when this ceases, that ceases. That's a little mini causal series. In other words, every phenomena or every experience that arises dependent on a previous experience. This is kind of part of the Buddha's classic teaching. That's what we mean by dependently arising. This experience we're having right now, we're having a body and mind experience, are we not? Isn't there a body and mind experience happening right now? This particular one that each one of us is having is arising dependent on a previous body and mind experience. It's slightly different than the previous, and it's quite different from last year's, and it's very different from 50 years ago, right? But there's relationship between this body and mind experience and the one 50 years ago. And that relationship is a kind of causal dependence. It's, and the same series. By series, we mean a particular series. I think that's what Russ is pointing at. But that's what series means in this case, is it's... And you can apply it to things other than people too, like a river, for example, is a convenient name for a causal series of water, pieces of water, right, arising and ceasing. Causal series of areas of water, right? There's not actually some entity called a river, but a river is a nice convenient name for this causal series, a particular causal series. We name it. This is the Mississippi River. We don't confuse it with some other, because it's this particular causal series of that river, of that moving, of those pieces of water, arising and ceasing dependent on other pieces of water and so on. And then we name it that, and we look at it from a distance, and we think it looks like an entity called a river. But when we get up close, we see that there's nothing permanent there. Right? It's just arising and ceasing, flow. In the same way, a person is a convenient designation or name for a causal series of body and mind experiences. We're a little different than a river, right? What our causal series is five skandhas. Body and mind experience is, I think, a nice colloquial way of talking about this technical term, five aggregates. Five aggregates is body, the form aggregate, and then the other four are different aspects of mind, relative mind, feelings and perceptions, mental tendencies, dualistic consciousness. So, body and mind experience, right now we're having is dependent on a previous moment of body and mind experience, which is dependent on a previous moment. And of course we don't mix them up. We don't, our experiences aren't all blending together. We have our unique causal series of body and mind experiences, which helps to explain things like karma. This body and mind does some action that affects others, but also has an effect on the body and mind causal series that did the action, right, later. That's why the Buddha's teaching of karma is that the results of our actions come back to the person who did them. And the Buddha can talk that way without saying that there's some essence of personhood that's flowing through this. It's just that the results of the action come back to the same causal series of body and mind experiences that did the action in some previous time. And also the theory of rebirth, according to the Buddha, doesn't need a continuous entity of self running through it that is reborn. You could say it's the causal series is reborn based on the karma of the causal series. So this is kind of early Buddhist teaching of karma and rebirth, all that fit very nicely into this teaching of a particular causal series of body and mind experiences with no essence of anything running through it, just dependent arising and ceasing. Is there some connection, is there something, some continuous thing that's arising and ceasing? No, that's often how we think, but there's no thing. There's just arising, a moment of being, and then ceasing, and then the cessation of this moment of body and mind creates the condition for the next arising of a new body and mind. That's the Buddha's early teaching of dependent arising. And is there an actual link between the previous moment, the cause and the next moment of the effect? There's not actually a link. They don't actually meet. They don't really touch. It's very mysterious. It's just dependent on the ceasing of this one, there is the arising of the next one. So, and I think it's important to, we can really spend a lot of time investigating how this dependent co-arising works. The Buddha says it's very subtle and difficult to really understand dependent arising without putting some thread of something in there that continues. It's just interdependence. Yes.
Why do you think it was so important to the Buddha to make that point so strongly that there is no connecting?
I think it was really important to the Buddha because that connecting thread could be the basis for grasping a true independent separate self. We're going to hear it. Any the slightest something continuing could easily become the basis for grasping some separate me. That's the problematic self. We haven't started talking really about this one. Here we're just talking about the relative self as this causal series. And as this one, as I said, it's not a problem. The causal series of body and mind experiences is not the source of our suffering. In fact, it's a source of benefit to us. It's good to consider myself as a convenient name for a causal series of body and mind experiences, because based on this we can take care of a future self that we will become. Mark Sideritz is the one who mentions this nice example of this body and mind brushes its teeth today, not because the dirty teeth are such a problem right now, but if I don't brush the teeth, in the future of this causal series, there will be cavities that will be painful and expensive to deal with.
That sure sounds like there's something that connects those two.
So now this is what's important, is to see how this is a causal series. We can understand this as a causal series of body and mind experiences with no thread or link other than just dependent arising.
Dependent arising is enough.
Yeah, it's enough. Exactly. Dependent arising is enough. I forgot. That could have been a nice early sutra. When people are saying, can't we have some thread of self whose teeth we can take care of? And the Buddha said, you don't really need some continuous self in order to take care of these teeth. Dependent arising is enough. Can you follow this point? It's a quite subtle point.
You're saying that there is the dependency means there's a link. There's just not a thread of self.
We could call, depending on what we call link.
Or there's a causal effect.
Yeah. If we by link we mean a dependent relationship.
Yeah.
A dependent relationship, we definitely have that. And we could call that a link. In fact, the Buddha does talk about the 12 links.
Right.
Nidana means something like link. But it's not a link. It's not a link that where things actually meet. If we look for the meeting place between the cause and the effect, all we find is interdependence. So when people,
there's so many other things that
there's other things too. Yeah,
that particular series is coming into.
That's right. In fact, all our individual causal series, if we can start relating to ourselves more and more as unique causal series, our causal series are all, of course, interdependent with each other. Like right now, this causal series is talking and other causal series are hearing, so that's an interdependent relationship. We are interdependent with each other, but we're also interdependent with our own earlier causal series experiences. It's completely interdependent, but nothing actually touches. So this is some, you know, often in modern Buddhism, people like to say, isn't the Buddha's main point is that everything is connected? I sometimes cringe a little bit when I hear connected. I like the word too, and I might use it sometimes too, but I think strictly speaking, if we're using language very carefully, I think it's like things aren't really connected in some way that they meet. They're interdependent. I think what when we say connected, we mean interdependent. Or like Thich Nhat Hanh's term, interbeing. I think that's okay.
That sure sounds like connected. Interbeing.
Depends how we mean the word terms, right? Connected for me has a sense of like linked somehow. And I think that's a little bit dangerous. It's a little...
determined.
Yeah, and it's a little bit like too... like things are actually somehow meet, whereas then you're into the realm of different entities touching and meeting, whereas this realm of interdependence, as I understand it, it's nothing actually meets or touches, but everything, it's more intimate than meeting and touching. It's more like interdependence allows for our unity in a way. So, you know, I think how we use these words in English, connected, I don't think there's any Sanskrit term for connected, but everything is interdependent with like Nagarjuna's teaching. And the way that this body and mind is dependent on the previous body and mind in this causal series is all about the interdependence. Yeah, it's hard to see. Yeah, and it really looks like there's an actual river, the same river. This is another way to say it is there's even an early Pali Sutta where I think somebody asked the Buddha something like, is this person now the same one as yesterday's or a different one? I think the sutra might even get it. It might even be about karma and saying, is the one that receives the effect now the same person as the one who did it or a different person? And the Buddha says very nicely, neither. It's not, if it was the same person, then that would be like a continuous self. If it were a completely different person that did the action, then there'd be no causality in that series. So the Buddha says, it's neither the same nor different are two extremes. And the middle way is interdependence, or this causality. This person who is receiving the results is dependent on the person who did the action. Yes?
You could also say that there are no things, that codependent arising means nothing stands alone. We tend to think things stand alone, like there are things and there's these boundaries. Yeah. Nothing stands alone.
Yeah. That's especially true in like Nagarjuna's later teaching is nothing stands alone or exists independently because it's interdependent with everything else. So, whereas the early teaching of dependent arising in the Theravada teachings is more about how the personal experience arises dependent on previous personal experience. It's kind of I think the early teaching of dependent arising is trying to explain what we're trying to do right now is the conventional sense of person and how that can work without there being some independent, singular, permanent, separate self. because when we hear that, we're just like, well, what about this? What, and why do I remember things from yesterday? And like, isn't that a self? I think partly the Buddha is trying to convince us we can have a sense of continuity and causality and responsibility and all these things that come with a causal series without there being some independent, singular, permanent, separate self. Yes.
It's been my observation through studying Buddhism for a long time that there's a big effort to define that thread out of existence, as though the only way that a thread could exist is if it were permanent and unchanging. And there's nothing permanent and unchanging, therefore the thread cannot exist. What about a thread that's not permanent and unchanging?
What would that be?
The thing that we're saying doesn't exist.
Seems to
maybe isn't a thread, maybe isn't any of the words we've used so far. It definitely isn't permanent and unchanging, but there might be a thing that for some reason, some good teaching reason, perhaps, what do they call those? Provisional teaching reason, the Buddha said, this doesn't exist. Don't end up over there. Pay attention to this hand here, the magician on the stage said. Pay no attention to this one over here.
Well, we're going to hear a lot more about the problems with the thread, a permanent thread.
Okay.
But remember, there's going to be three types of self, and one of them is a true self that's a little bit thread-like in a way, but we're not going to get into that today. So far we're talking about the conventional relative self that's not a problem at all. When the Buddha's saying, talking about anatman, he's not referring to this one that we've been talking about, the causal series. He's fine with the causal series, I propose. And actually, not only is it not a problem, but as I said, it's beneficial to see, understand ourselves as a causal series. If this is when we say, you know, children need to develop like a sense of self, as they have to distinguish themselves as a kind of causal series, at least, so that they will brush their teeth to take care of their future teeth, right? So that's good. There's good reasons we can take care of the future, because we know how the causal series works. There will be a person who will suffer or be happy in the future. Dependent on this one, we can create good future conditions for this causal series. All that is, I think, not what the Buddha's saying is the problem, right? So this is the conventional self. Now what's the false self? If this is a conventionally true self, there's another self that's like not even conventionally true. It's a complete illusion. It's a falsity. It's an imagination. And this is the one where the Buddha's saying, talking about anatman, this is the self I would propose that doesn't exist. And incidentally, some people, when they hear anatman, they think, we read this sometimes in Buddhist teachings in modern times. The Buddha was all about refuting the pre-Buddhist teachings of the atman, or like a true self. But the more I study this, the more I see, I don't think that's what the Buddha was concerned about. Later Buddhist tradition might start getting a little bit into that, because there was a lot of sectarian stuff going on in India. You have to refute that teaching. But that true self of like the Upanishads was not an ego source of suffering self. They have other words for that, like ahamkara is like the separate ego self. But the atman was like a spiritual transcendent self. And it looks like the early Buddhist teachings anyway is not trying to refute that one or dispute that one. It looks to me like the Buddha is trying to refute the same one that the Upanishads would be trying to refute, which is the separate, independent, we might call ego self, like that is the source of suffering. And how are we going to define this one? If we say the relative conventional truth is a convenient name for a causal series of body and mind experiences, no problem. This false illusion of a separate self is the belief and feeling, maybe we could even say like a deeply rooted, some Buddhist tradition says innate, like we're actually born with this illusion, and it's deeply hidden and unconscious, and it's an unconscious belief that we hold, and feeling that goes with the belief, based on the unconscious belief, that I am a permanent, singular, independent, separate entity called me, the self. I think one thing we can explore is singular and permanent and independent and separate. I think those four in particular are nice to look at. That's the problem here. Another way to say it, this definition, to tie it into the previous definition, is the deeply seated, innate, unconscious belief and feeling that I am some kind of like owner or controller or experiencer of the causal series of body and mind experiences. Yeah, so this, I think it ties the two together. The causal series, no problem. But if I feel that I am the full definition would be something like the deep unconscious belief and feeling based on the belief that I am a controller or owner or experiencer of this unique causal series of body and mind experiences.
Well, who else would experience it?
Could there be just a causal series of body and mind experiences? Remember, five skandhas describe our whole realm of experience. They include perception and consciousness, for example, which are dependently arising phenomena. They include, the fourth skandha includes volition, or, the capacity to make decisions, for example, is a dependently arisen factor in the fourth aggregate. So all the functions of experiencing person can happen without there being an experiencer. So if we summarize it into one word, we could say the conventional apparent self, this causal series, we could summarize it into one word as experience. Who am I just conventionally? I'm just experience. We're just a bunch of experiences. We could call them experience. Whereas this separate entity is called the experiencer. So can we have just experience happening without there being some experiencer? Notice how experience experiences are just events happening. Whereas experiencer has this ER on the end, makes it kind of into kind of an entity. Notice how all those words, controller, owner, experiencer, are all kind of like something, feels like some sort of entity that's separate. It either feels like it's separate from the five skandhas. It's kind of like the controller of the five skandhas. It's like this person in the control tower, like kind of hanging on the back of the five skandhas, kind of like, go that way, this way. That would be the controller. Or the owner would be some sort of like, the boss of the five skandhas. We feel as if there's somebody like that. Or the, maybe the most subtle would just be like the experiencer of the five skandhas. Something either a little bit outside the five skandhas that experiences them, or some part of the five skandhas, something in the body and mind that we kind of feel is like, there's like a little entity of like a little chip or something that's really our essence, and it's somehow hidden in our body and mind experience, but it's really like the source of the whole program. We sometimes feel like this is the case.
The Buddha said apparently events happen, deeds are done, but there is no doer.
Nice. Yes. Yeah, the Buddha said that. There, deeds happen, there's no doer. Actions happen, but there's no actor. I think this is exactly the point, yeah. And it's kind of counterintuitive, because the Buddha's proposing that we believe in this sort of entity, some, again, permanent, we feel like there's some ongoing, like this gets into the thread thing, like there's something, body and mind, everything in the body and mind, the five skandhas, is continuously arising and ceasing. Even consciousness, the fifth aggregate, the Buddha defines as a moment-to-moment arising and ceasing, conditioned phenomena. Consciousness arises dependent on an object. So anything in there is, there's nothing continuous, so it's why it's all the five aggregates are impermanent. And because there's five aggregates, they're actually, it's multiple. Our experience is a great multiplicity. There's no singular thing there. And all the stuff in the five aggregates is interdependent with each other and with other sets of aggregates. So this point about we feel as if there's something that doesn't fit that criteria. We feel like there's something that's permanent. How could that be part of the five aggregates? We feel like there's something singular. How could that be part of five aggregates? We feel like there's something independent, like exists on its own. It's not dependent on causes and conditions. And we feel like that it's like it's separate. It's somehow separate from other entities, other selves.
I like the whole, you're talking about that, I'm thinking of gut flora. And, you know, how they've done all this research recently that so much of what we think and feel is affected by these billions of bacteria.
Yeah. 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 There's billions of us.
So that feeling actually has some basis in conventional truth, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I can only sort of begin to grasp some of this by thinking in those ways.
Yep, that's an example how even like our body is not one singular thing either.
And there's all these cells, mm-hmm. sort of kind of units.
Yeah.
They're all somehow working together.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And in these organ systems, and then somehow yeah. these organ systems are working together in this incredibly coordinated way.
Yep.
It's dependent on all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. And our emotions are dependent on the gut and so on. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So all that stuff can be happening. We can have all kinds of complex emotions. We can brush our teeth. We can plan for the future. We can do all kinds of functional things. We can relate to each other. All of this can happen quite fine without there being this separate thing. And we could say, well, why then do we have this? Why are we born with, if we are this illusory belief that is so hidden that we never even stop to question it. We can't even find it as a conceptual belief because it's so deep. But you could say, well, how do we know that we have it? It seems to me like it's revealed through our actions. We act sometimes anyway as if there is this belief when we're, for example, a nice one, they say, if you feel like, I don't really have this belief, I don't think, a way to test it is like, wait till you're falsely accused of something. And, you know, even accused at all, but especially falsely accused, when you feel this sense of self-righteousness and justification, all this defense emotion comes in to defend myself, you could say that's, there it is. We can't see the conceptual belief, but there's the effect of it, the sign that there's something more than just a causal series we're defending. The causal series is like, we still maybe want to point out that, no, actually, that's not really true about this causal series. But we have a little more energy than that, right?
So invested.
We're invested, yeah. Yeah.
In the idea.
Yeah. So maybe just to close, we can continue with this false self discussion next time, but I think it's good to remember the practical thing about this, the points of suffering, or why this is, Buddha made such a big deal of this separate false illusion of self. There's so much problem. For example, if we feel like we're the controller or the overseer or the owner of our body and mind, of our life, our life and our body and mind cannot be controlled. And if we think that we're the controller, we're going to suffer. So that's one example of, you can have a body and mind that's out of control. It's not really a problem until the controller is trying to control it. The decider or the chooser, that is another form of the separate self. The kind of decider of the body and mind's destiny, right? You could say, then we have this burden of responsibility. I have to decide. According to this model, decisions happen just due to dependent arising. And so-called free will is just a dependently arisen phenomena too. We don't have to worry so much about it. We know that if we don't brush our teeth, we'll have cavities, so we brush our teeth. It's not a big deal. But if I have to, like, you know, figure out my life, it's a burden of responsibility that we don't need. The experiencer, the sense of being the experiencer as a separate self, what's so bad about that? We feel like then suffering, there can be suffering in this body and mind, but if I'm the experiencer, it's happening to me. It's my suffering. And that's much worse than just a body and mind undergoing suffering. It's my suffering. And another sense of the separate self would be like a sort of commentator or assessor or like the judge of our causal series. We do that, right? And then we're always going to feel like we're not good enough. We're going to get into the self-judgment. The body and mind causal series might be messing up sometimes, but, you know, it naturally learns by itself by just being a causal series. We evolve positively just by learning and paying attention. But we add in this extra thing of like the assessor, the commentator, the judge that's like, you should be doing better, you causal series. And so much suffering that's unnecessary. So these are some examples of when we add in this extra entity that's not necessary and not really there, the false illusion of the separate, independent, singular, permanent self, it comes along with all of this, particularly existential suffering. I think, you know, there's suffering of old age, sickness, and death, right? But the Buddha was like, well, that's just going to happen to the causal series. But the existential suffering that has to do with being, feeling ourselves as a separate person, humans have so much of that, and I think that's what the Buddha is really addressing. So that's a kind of brief overview of two types of these three types of self. The relative conventional self that appears as a convenient name for a causal series of body and mind experiences, and then the false illusion of the separate self as the kind of hidden view or hidden belief and the feeling that comes with it of being a separate, independent, singular, permanent owner, controller, experiencer of the causal series. It's a lot to consider for this week. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.